great to just make a difference in the world. It's kind of practicing, if you will, practicing what we preach, living out our values in our local community. All right, well, this morning we're continuing our series that's called God is Not Distant. And we've been in this series. This is actually week 4 of this series. We've been exploring practices that have helped people increase their awareness of God's presence in their everyday lives. Now, I got to say at the beginning of this message, I think we got to be careful. Anytime we start talking about being aware of God's presence, and particularly sensing God's presence, because I don't know about you, but there have been times in my life when I have determined how near God was to me or distant God was from me by how I felt. And if I'm being totally honest, and I don't know why I say that, because hopefully I am always being totally honest. But if I'm being totally honest, in some of my more unhealthy seasons, I've determined that God was distant from me because of my disobedience, because of something that I had done, as though God's acceptance and God's love was somehow contingent or conditioned upon how well or how successful I was at living up to some standard. And this way of thinking is not only spiritually and psychologically unhealthy, but it's also out of sync with the scriptures that teach us about God's unconditional love. And maybe you need to hear this. No matter where you are in life, no matter what you've done in your life, no matter what your struggles are, God loves you, God accepts you, God is present with you. Now, at the same time, there have been times in my life when I've sensed what I can only describe as the nearness or the presence of God. And these times always seem to catch me by surprise. And I don't really know what to make of them. And although I've tried to replicate these experiences, I've not been able to reproduce them in any kind of reliable or meaningful way. And what I've learned is that it's extremely difficult to manufacture a spiritual experience. Now, more often what ends up happening in my life is I end up leaning into practices that manipulate my emotions and create feelings of wonder and awe. And while these practices may create something similar to a spiritual experience, it typically has proven to be kind of a shallow, short-lived, even superficial experience that leaves me unchanged, not transformed, and really in search for the next spiritual fix, if you will, instead of me learning to rest in the knowledge that God loves me, God is for me, God is present with me. And so in this series, really what we're trying to do is explore the long tradition of people who have cultivated a deeper awareness of God's transforming presence through practices that they integrate into their everyday lives. And in week 1 of this series, Matthew walked us through the role of community and becoming aware of God's presence in our lives. And then in week 2, Ruth walked us through contemplative practices and really going inward and sitting in silence and engaging in prayer practices as a way of becoming aware of God's presence. And then last week, as I said at the beginning, we engaged in service as a reminder and a way to display that our God is an active God and his presence is not just present in here, but out there all over our communities, wherever we go. God is present there. And in this morning, we are looking at becoming more aware of God's presence through activism. Now, activism is probably not the first thing that comes to your mind when you think about sacred pathways or spiritual practices. And maybe that's because activism itself is not necessarily a spiritual practice. In fact, I think the Wikipedia definition, which is kind of religiously agnostic, if you will, the Wikipedia definition provides a pretty good definition of activism. So instead of me trying to cherry pick scriptures and proof text and try to create some definition for activism from the Bible, which isn't a biblical word, We'll just start with this Wikipedia definition and see what Wikipedia says about it. So it says, activism or advocacy consists of efforts to promote, impede, direct, or intervene in social, political, economic, or environmental reform with the desire to make changes in society toward a perceived greater good. Now, I think that's a pretty good definition. The only thing I would add to it is to partner with God. So I would have it read, activism consists of advocacy, or activism or advocacy consists of efforts to promote, impede, direct, or intervene in social, political, or economic, or environmental reform with the desire to partner with God to make changes in society toward a perceived greater good. And that's just to acknowledge that God is already at work out in our community, and we're just joining the work that God is already doing. We are partnering with God. We're not taking God to our community. God is already at work. He's already doing stuff in our community. He's already making, healing, fixing the brokenness in our world. And we want to be partners with God in that work. We want to align our concerns with the character of God. And that's what happens when we partner with God. Now, what you see in this definition is that activism is a visionary activity. It's rather forward-looking, if you will. It's not covering our eyes and denying reality, but rather it's about looking intently and intentionally at the state of our world and imagining something different, imagining something better, imagining a more whole, more loving, more just, more peaceful, more inclusive world. This kind of imagination forms the core of an activist or our efforts as a community to imagine a better place. Activism in this sense is fundamentally, and I'm going to use a biblical word. Activism in this sense is a prophetic practice. Now, don't let my use of the word prophetic confuse you or distract you. You know, sometimes we reduce the work of the prophet to predicting the future or fortune telling, but that's not what I'm talking about here. In fact, if you look in the Hebrew Bible, there's a whole section of a literature called prophetic literature. You can think about books like Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah. In these books, we see that the work of the prophet is not so much futuristic as much as it is formational. Prophets are calling people to be something, to exist in a kind of way in the world. And so when we look at the prophets, what we see is that they're often deeply burdened by the state of the world, the condition of the world, and they're calling people to live into a different future, a future that's more in line with the character of God, a more just future. And so prophets imagined a better world, and then they called people to embody it. You see, the work of the prophet is not about predicting the future, but rather about creating the future. Now, in 1978, an Old Testament scholar and theologian, Walter Brueggemann, wrote a book called Prophetic Imagination. And since that book was released, it's kind of become a classic, if you will. It's still read as though it was written today because it's still very relevant in our world. And it's almost become a pocket manual, if you will, for people who are frustrated with the way things are in the world and desiring a different world to spring up from the midst of this kind of broken and divided world that we live in. And in this book, Walter Brueggemann explores the prophet's role in imagining a transformed society. Now, one of my favorite quotes comes from this book, and I don't think I've read this quote here at Cedar Ridge, but it's one of my favorite quotes. And so you're going to hear it this morning, and you'll probably hear it again when I speak, because I think it's so important and relevant for our time. So Brueggemann says this. He says, the prophet does not ask if the vision can be implemented, for questions of implementation are of no consequence until the vision can be imagined. The imagination, he says, must come before implementation. In other words, we have to be able to genuinely imagine a different world and what that world would look like, what it would feel like, what would be different from how it would be different from the reality that we're currently living in. And what I like about this quote is Brueggemann goes on and he kind of critiques our culture, critiques the world. And he says, our culture is competent to implement almost anything and imagine almost nothing. I don't know that. Every time I read that, that hits me. Our culture is competent to implement almost anything and imagine almost nothing. And so when it comes to pathways to a more peaceful, loving, just, inclusive world, our imagination tends to fall short. And really, that's what he's getting at. And sadly, what often ends up happening is we become complicit in the very systems and we perpetuate the injustices we desire to stand against simply because we cannot imagine another way. Now, you don't have to look very hard for examples of this. Our government is crippled, hopelessly, it feels, divided because of a failure of imagination. The criminal justice system is rendered ineffective often at rehabilitating and restoring those who have broken laws. Our economic system is struggling to create equitable access for all. Our housing system still leaves many unhoused, living in unsafe, unstable situations. Our planet is warming. We've littered the earth. We're destroying the ecosystem. We're losing biodiversity. And much of this is the result of a failure of imagination. We can't see another way forward enough to work towards it together. A failure of imagination to see a different, a better, a more whole and healed way. Therefore, activism is first and foremost, I think, a practice of imagining a different way, imagining a different way in this world, an alternative to the way things are. And for us as a community dedicated, a community of hope and transformation dedicated to following Jesus, activism is about imagining a way that's more in line with the character of God. Now, this morning, I'm not going to try to cover all the nuances of this complicated topic. We could spend a year talking about activism and the history of it and theory and methods. This kind of sounds like a name of a college course, theory and methods of activism. We could really dive deep in that. And so I'm not going to really do that, nor am I going to explore the various causes because there's tons that we could get into and we could be here all day just looking at all the causes that are worth standing up for and advocating on behalf of. But instead, I really want to use the remainder of our time this morning to tell you three stories that I believe will help frame our understanding of how we could live in a more just way and increase our awareness of God in our everyday lives. All right, so first I want to tell you a little bit of my own story and journey with activism. So I feel like I need to make a confession here at the beginning of this story. Sort of the beginning of this message. I guess I'm into it now. If you would have asked me several years ago, I probably would have told you that I am not an activist. You know, for a long time, I felt a fair amount of guilt because I thought I should be more passionate, more expressive about my dissatisfaction with the condition of the world. I mean, I know people that get so frustrated over injustice and the brokenness of our world that they can hardly sleep at night. I know a guy that told me the other day, he says, I get so angry over injustice, I can't see straight. And maybe that's you. There's lots of people in our world that just get so frustrated over injustice and brokenness and the pain that seems to be perpetuated, ongoing in our world. And so for much of my life, I felt like I was supposed to feel that way, feel strongly. And I wondered if something was wrong with me because I didn't feel that way. And it's only recently that I've come to peace with the fact that I'm just not wired to feel really strong emotions. And I could ramble on and on about why that is and why I think that is the case. But to make a long story short, I just don't get angry that often or get frustrated that often. And I'm not a very emotionally driven person. In fact, I'm a, if you're familiar with the Enneagram, I'm an Enneagram 5, right? And now some of you who are familiar with the Enneagram are probably judging me right now because fives tend to be, we just tend to be an interesting bunch. There aren't a ton of us. So now some of you are going to go home and look up Enneagram when you get home because you're like, wait, what is he talking about? you know, I've always concluded that that's must be just the way God knit me together in my mother's womb. And so when I look around and I see other people, particularly people in my family, when I look around at other people in my family, what I see is that they're kind of wired the same way, particularly the men in my family. And I think I'm actually one of the more emotionally expressive members of my family. And so several years ago, sitting with a counselor and wrestling with some of this stuff, I came to the conclusion that it's just genetic. That's just the way I'm wired. And then I had to do the hard work of stop trying to be like other people and feel the emotions and the feelings that other people feel and be content with how I was created. And I had to learn to live authentically in my own body with my personality, not trying to mimic or be like anyone else. In fact, one day, I had a friend, and this is after I had done all this work about being content with who I am and coming to understand kind of this whole process of self-discovery. I had a friend that said to me, I'm going to pray that God makes you more emotionally expressive, because he was looking at me and he just couldn't fathom going through life in my body with my brain operating the way I do. To be honest, I couldn't fathom going through life in his body with his brain, seeing life the way he sees it. And to be honest, there's nothing, one is not right and one is not right wrong. We're just wired differently. And I'm going to tell you something, but it has to stay in this room. But I actually told him, I said, I'm going to pray that God doesn't hear your prayer. Now, of course, I wasn't totally serious, but I was kind of serious, right? Because I didn't want him praying that prayer for me, right? Because I was content with the way I was, well, not all of his prayers, just that one prayer about me becoming more emotionally expressive, because I was happy with who I was, and I had seen the strengths in my personality, and I had learned to lean into those. And that's, a beautiful thing. All right, so my confession time is over, but I think what I want us to see from this is kind of a deeper, more serious point, and that's that activism isn't a personality trait. Rather, it's a posture we take. That activism ultimately isn't a personality trait. It's not about how you're wired. It's not about some people have it and other people don't. Some people get so angry they can't do anything but make a difference or at least try. But rather, it's a posture. It's an intentional posture that we take, a way that we live in the world. I can intentionally live in a way that honors God. I can intentionally live in a way that aligns my concerns with the character of God. Now, do I struggle with apathy and complacency? Of course I do. We kind of all have our struggles, and that is an obstacle, though, that can't be overcome. You see what? We can work together. All of us can work together, no matter how we're wired, whether we feel all the feels and emotions or not, we can all work together to intentionally live in a way that we honor God. Now, liberation theologians have given us a simple phrase to help discern the character and the concerns of God. They say, God is on the side of the oppressed. You may have heard that before. God is on the side of the oppressed. And that means that we, if we're going to posture ourselves toward the character and concerns of God, we must be on the side of the oppressed as well, if we're going to live a life that honors God. Now look at some scriptures that make this clear. In Psalm 82, verse 3, it says, defend the weak and the fatherless, uphold the causes of the poor and the oppressed. In Proverbs 29, verse 7, it says, the righteous care about justice for the poor, but the wicked have no such concern. In Proverbs 31, verse 9, it says, speak up and judge fairly, defend the rights of the poor and needy. Jeremiah 22, verse 3 says, this is what the Lord says, do what is just and right, rescue from the hand of the oppressor, the one who's been robbed. Do no wrong or violence to the foreigner, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place. In Zechariah 7, verse 9 and 10, it says, this is what the Lord Almighty said, administer true justice, show mercy and compassion to one another. Do not oppress the widow or the fatherless, the foreigner or the poor. Do not plot evil against the other or each other. Micah 6, verse 8 says, he has shown you, O mortal, what is good and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. You see, activism isn't a personality trait. It's a posture we take. And if we as a community are going to be partners with God to make the world a better place, we got to be on the side of the oppressed as God is, concerned with the things that God is concerned about. We have to intentionally choose this way of being in the world. All right, that's story number one. I was a little vulnerable there. Let me get comfortable again. Story number two. Second story I want you to see is the much abbreviated story of Moses. Moses is one of the most popular and fascinating characters in the Hebrew Bible. Much of Moses' story is in the book of Exodus, but he's actually mentioned all throughout the Bible. And if you're familiar with the book of Exodus, the book opens and then takes a quite dramatic turn right in chapter one. After opening on this positive note with the Israelites migrating into Egypt because of a famine so that they could kind of be saved from starvation, they migrate into Egypt, and then suddenly everything begins to change. And I'll let the text speak for itself, starting in Exodus 1, verse 8. It says, then a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing came to power. So Joseph was kind of the leader, the one who welcomed the Israelites into Egypt. And so a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and work them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor and brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. And so, as you can see, the situation for Israel in Egypt changed dramatically, where they were being oppressed and working to build a nation that they themselves could not enjoy. And along comes this guy named Moses, who was born to an Israelite woman, but was adopted into this Egyptian family. Actually, it was Pharaoh, the king's daughter, that adopted Moses. Now, ethnically, he was a Hebrew, but he was nurtured. He was socialized as an Egyptian. And so he identified with both groups, both the oppressor and the oppressed. All right, talk about a complicated way to live in this world. As an adult, conflicted and confused, Moses makes this rash decision to act on behalf of the oppressed, but not in a way that honors God. In fact, look at Exodus chapter 2, verse 11, at what it says. It says one day Moses had grown up. After Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people, looking this way and that and seeing no one. He killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. So as we read this story, make no mistake about it, this is not a form of activism that honors God, right? This is simply a form of violence, vengeance, taking things into our own hand and acting out of line with God's character. Now, when Pharaoh finds out about this, he attempts to kill Moses, but Moses escapes, runs for his life, and ends up in the wilderness. And he actually lives there in the wilderness for 40 years. He builds a family in the wilderness. And he actually has this peculiar experience, encounter, if you will, with God in the wilderness that transforms his life and ultimately reorients him and sets his life in a different course. And so God speaks to Moses and calls him to return to Egypt and act as a nonviolent, this time, activist to advocate for the liberation of the Hebrew people. Now, at first, Moses is super reluctant, right? You're familiar with the story, he got all the excuses, right? I always identify with Moses. I can't tell you how many years it took for me to actually go into ministry. Well, I was like Moses, I gave God every excuse why this was not what I should, why I should not be standing right here. And Moses did that. So I always identify with Moses' story. So at first, Moses is super reluctant to return to Egypt. His imagination, right, for what is possible is failing. He can only see the reasons why it won't work and why he should remain in the wilderness and live a quiet life and stay out of harm's way. But he eventually returns to Egypt and connects with the Hebrew community. Look at what it says in Exodus chapter 4, verse 29. It says, Moses and Aaron brought together all the elders of the Israelites, and Aaron told them everything the Lord had said to Moses. He also performed the signs before the people, and they believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshiped. You see, Moses became a part of a supportive spiritual community that worshiped God together. And then from this place of belonging to the community, Moses engages in a long campaign to free the Hebrew people from Pharaoh's violent and oppressive regime. Moses became an activist as a man belonging to a certain kind of community, a supportive community. Now, from Moses' story, what we see is that activism is sustained by community, not by causes. The activism sustained by community, our belonging in a community, not by causes. There's so much going on in our world today, right? So much for us to be concerned about, so many causes for us to be consumed with. And I think we should run hard after making this world a better place. I think that's our responsibility as a community dedicated to following Jesus. We should work hard to make this world a more just and equitable place. But we gotta acknowledge that social justice fatigue is real. We can get exhausted when we try to focus on all the concerns that fix all the problems of our world. You can chase after all the causes. In fact, we can do that and feel good about it for a season. But if we're not connected to a community of support, we're bound to flame out and fail to be the change we desire to see in the world. You know, it's okay to rest for a while, to simply be a part of a community that feeds you, that supports you, that heals you, before re-engaging in the work of making this world a more just place. But we must re-engage. I don't know if your personality is anything like mine, you might withdraw for a while and be like, it's comfortable here. But we have to withdraw intentionally before re-engaging in the work for justice. Here's the thing I want you to hear. Causes don't care about the condition of your soul. The community does. And that's why activism isn't sustained by, or activism is sustained by community, not by causes. I think we see that in Moses' story. All right, story number three. I told y'all there's three stories I want to tell you this morning. Story number three. Now, I'm sure we're all familiar with scenes from the March on Washington that happened just up the road in 1963 at the National Mall. It was the largest gathering of civil rights activists of the time. An estimated 250 people were in attendance. It's here that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered what is arguably his most famous, or arguably the most famous speech of the 20th century. In that speech, King allowed himself to dream out loud a little bit. He engages in prophetic imagination with the simple yet powerful refrain, "I have a dream." These words became famous because they gave dimension and texture to the dream that so many people had who were longing to live in an equal and inclusive nation. Now, King may have been the face of the civil rights movement, and the impact of his leadership, honestly, is undeniable. However, his influence and legacy would have been greatly reduced without a community gathered around him, a community sustaining the work he engaged in. His community, they were the organizers, the architects, the strategists of the civil rights movement. Now, I like King as much as anybody else, but sometimes I believe we get so focused on the man that we forget the movement and we overlook the many women and men that gave their life to making this nation a better place. In fact, if you look at this picture of Dr. Martin Luther King at the March on Washington, you'll see just behind him a man named Bayard Rustin. There he is. The March on Washington would have never happened without Rustin's organizing efforts. And many of us have probably never heard his name. It's his story that I want to tell. Because Rustin was a trusted advisor to King and the chief organizer of the March on Washington. And the march would have never happened without his genius brain and that put together all the details. So Bayard Rustin was born not far from here, just up the road in Pennsylvania, Westchester, Pennsylvania, on March 17, 1912. At the time, Westchester had a large Quaker population, and because many Quakers were abolitionists, the town played a significant role in the Underground Railroad, and many Black families ended up settling there. Rustin was raised by his grandmother, Julia Davis Rustin, who was an ambitious, strong, independent, entrepreneurial woman. And although it was unusual for a Black woman to be educated in that day, Julia Rustin was educated by the Quakers and trained as a nurse. And she was a brilliant businesswoman. In fact, she started a day school for the kids of Black working mothers. And Julia Rustin, as a result of her kind of her education and upbringing, she had a deep appreciation for the Quakers. And so she often attended their worship service. And these services were known for their unstructured worship and times, extended periods of time, sitting in silence and contemplation. Julia Rustin was also a member of the African American Episcopal AME Church, which is not as well acquainted with silence, if you will. And so Bayard Rustin was influenced by both of these traditions. As an adult, he was known for spending extended periods of time in silence, especially when he was faced with a difficult decision. He would go inward. He would do what the theologian Howard Thurman calls listening for the sound of the genuine in himself before making a decision. And this contemplative inward practice allowed him to show up in the world with authenticity and integrity. But Rustin was also known for singing, making a joyful noise. He would walk around just singing songs which he used to uplift his spirit and access joy as an act of resistance against the harsh realities of life in America as a Black male. And Rustin wasn't just discriminated against because of his Blackness. He was also an openly gay man at a time when same-sex relationships were criminalized in this country. And many gay people felt like they had no option but to stay in the closet. However, Rustin, inspired by the strength, the resilience, and the deep love of his grandmother, came out the closet to his grandmother at an early age. And you got to remember, this is in the early 1900s. And as the story goes, when Rustin told his grandmother that he was gay, she simply said, "I suppose that's just what you need to do." And she continued loving him, affirming him, accepting him, embracing him, because that's what love does. Now, in 1930, Rustin moved to Manhattan and became involved in politics, community organizing, fighting against racism, discrimination, and inequality. And the impact of Rustin's life is super hard for us to measure, but we can say with certainty that the world is a more just and more equitable, more loving, more peaceful place because of Rustin's commitment to organizing communities of activists who imagined a more inclusive society. In fact, Rustin is credited with coining the term that so many people use today, speaking truth to power. And sadly, so many people that use that phrase have never heard of Bayard Rustin because his story was largely erased from the historical record because of who he chose to love. Now, recently, our world has started to recognize the significance of his life. In fact, in 2018, Rockville named a new school the Bayard Rustin Elementary School. And last year, just last year, a fantastic film came out. It was released on Rustin's work of organizing the March on Washington. It's on Netflix. You should watch it, right? It's simply called Rustin, because we need to know more about men and women like Bayard Rustin who gave their life to making this world a better place for all of us. He was an organizer. He was a leader. He was a visionary. He was a dreamer. He was a gay Black man who dared to imagine a world that no longer marginalized people because of their race, ethnicity, economic status, sexuality. You know, it would have been easier, of course, for Rustin to live a quiet life, a simpler life, not to make much noise. But he just couldn't stop imagining a different world, imagining a better world, imagining a more just world. You see, Bayard Rustin's life demonstrates for us that activism is energized by inward journey and intentional joy. I think we can learn that from Bayard Rustin. Silence and singing fueled his work of advocating for a more just world. Like Rustin, I think if we want to be the change we want to see in the world, we got to go deep. We got to go inward. We have to become acquainted with silence, interrogating the condition of our soul so that we can live, so that we can show up in this world with authenticity, integrity, and courage. And we must be intentional about accessing joy, one of the most profound emotions. I may not be very emotional. But I've learned that joy plays an important role on my journey. And I've been intentional about it. I think we have to be intentional about accessing joy for our journey. Joy is an act of resistance. Joy is energy for the journey. Joy is hope when all seems hopeless. The thing I love about Bayard Rustin's story is that Rustin discovered joy. And I believe that it's out of this joy that he proclaimed what is still true today. And that's that we need in every community a group of angelic troublemakers. We need in every community a group of angelic troublemakers. That's all I got to say about that. Let's pray. God, we're grateful. And we're grateful for those who have gone before us. We're grateful for those who carry the flame of justice, lighting the way for others and illuminating a path towards a world where all are seen, where all are heard, where all are valued. God, grant us strength to be steadfast in our pursuit of justice. Give us the courage to speak out against oppression and wisdom to discern where our efforts are most needed. God, may our actions be guided by love, empathy, and a deep sense of interconnectedness with all beings. We pray, be with those who are on the front lines of change, even those who are risking, or especially those who are risking their safety and comfort for the betterment of humanity. May they find resilience in their struggle and hope in their victories. Help us to remember that activism is not about grand gestures or momentous achievements, but about daily choices we make to uphold dignity, equity, and compassion in all our interactions with others. And may we join with those who've gone before us, carrying the flame of justice, lighting the way for others, and illuminating a path towards a world where all are seen, heard, and valued. These things we ask and pray. Amen. Well, this morning, we have an opportunity to gather around table with one another and share in communion. There's three tables around the room. There's one in the center and two on the sides where communion has been prepared, and we can remember the way of Jesus. There was a way of love through struggle and opposition, but also a way where we see that love wins, that love overcame all the forces of this world that sought to silence it. And so we can gather around these tables and we can remember that, but also celebrate that with one another. There's also other ways that we can, other things we can do, ways of responding that are in the flyer that you should have gotten when you came in. You may just want to spend time in prayer, but the table's open for absolutely everyone to come and participate. So when you're ready, feel free to either make your way to one of these tables or spend some time in prayer, visit one of our stations at the side, or even just fellowship with one another.